sure why this is not working.
The pointer doesn't work. Is it means the pointer
doesn't work? No, just the well, let's see. Nothing works. Maybe it's not on.
Battery dead.
I'll just go ask for.
I think you can recharge your batteries. I don't know.
You have like 15?
Yeah. Well, it lasts longer than that.
No, recharge.
Oh, I don't know. I want the Sanyo analytic ones. Did I discharge?
Are they in memory? Or are they whole? Because they don't.
Okay, so good morning. Let's continue talking about how to update these SSE configurations. So let me point out one thing which I forgot to do yesterday. I mean, the general strategy for updating these configurations. So what we have here is three configurations, and then we have these operator locations within the spin configurations, right? And as I pointed out many times, we only need to store really one of these states, at least in one part of the simulation. And we need to store the operator locations. And we talked about this link vertex storage as well. But the whole point of all this is that we need to sample these configurations, like we sample an Ising model. When we do more classical Monte Carlo simulations, we just flip these spins and accept or reject with an appropriate probability. Now this configuration space is of course more complicated. We have spin and operators. But the main thing is really the operators, as we will see. We will actually not have to worry much about sampling the spin configurations. Well, it will actually be done at the same time as sampling these operators. But how do we sample the operators? So we started to talk about this diagonal update. And that's what we use to insert and remove operators. But we only do that using these diagonal operators. So going through this space, we attempt to remove ones where we have them, and we attempt to insert ones where we can, for example here, where there's no operator. Okay, so that's just one update, of course. That will not affect these off-diagonal operators. There will be another kind of update which will not do anything to the locations of these operators, just change their types. So just change the color of them from black to white here, off diagonal to diagonal and vice versa. So in combination with these diagonal update where we fluctuate the number of operators and the locations of operators, that will actually be enough to sample the whole space. So that's the point. And so this diagonal update that we started to talk about, that's done only using one spin state at a time. So we will go up here and advance the spin state, meaning flipping a couple of spins each time we hit one of these off-diagonal operators. Whereas that other update to change the types of the operators, that will be done with this data structure that we call the linked vertex representation that we talked about last time, where we are able to move around in a way which reflects how these operators are, so to speak, connected to each other. And then we can change the types of them. So now we just yesterday talked about how to insert and remove, and that's how we change the locations and the numbers of these things. So we did that yesterday. Let me quickly just show how that is done in pseudocode form. I will go quite quickly, and later you can look in more detail, but just to give you a flavor. So these are the locations of the operators, 0 to L minus 1. So that corresponds to the location in an array, a one-dimensional array, where we store these operators. And the operators are stored as these numbers S, which is encoding both the location and the type of the operator, as you remember. So if S is 0, that means there's no operator there, or there's a unit operator there. So that's when we want to insert a real Hamiltonian diagonal operator. We generate the bond at random. And then, as you recall, we can only operate on anti-parallel spins, and the spins are stored in sigma, and the bonds connected to the sites connected to bond B are on are sites I and J. So this is a list that we have constructed in advance, which reflects the lattice that we are looking at. So if the spins are parallel, that means we are not allowed to do that kind of update. So cycle means that we just skip and do the next iteration of the loop. So the next option here is that this S of P is an even number, and as you recall, that corresponds to having a diagonal operator there. So that's when we, what happens if we don't cycle. So if you don't cycle, that means that the spins are actually anti-parallel. We can try to insert it. And this is the insert probability. So this is just the probability we discussed yesterday for actually inserting the operator, if we are allowed to do so. So then inserting it corresponds to filling this element with 2 times B. So again, even number will correspond to diagonal operator, and B was the bond index that we generated at random. And then N is the number of operators we have in the sequence, so now that will be incremented by 1. Okay, the other option was that if there is already an even non-zero number there, then that means we have a diagonal operator that we can try to remove, and this is the removal probability. So we generate the random number between 0 and 1, and if that is satisfied, then we remove it, meaning we put 0 in that place, and the number of operators is now 1 less. The third option is that we had an odd integer there. That means there's an off-diagonal operator. This is the actual bond. We just take this this number and divide it by 2 to extract B, and then we flip those spins. So we just set those sigmas to the negative values. Okay, I did it in kind of detail, but I hope at least that makes it clear. Yeah?
Is the number of iterators changing?
The number of
operators?
Yeah, so the number of operators is changing. So that's N, right? So the length of the operator sequence is L, which is fixed. With the trick we talked about yesterday, inserting these unit operators. But N is the actual number of Hamiltonian operators. So that's increased by 1 here and decreased by 1 there.
Okay, so you don't count identity operator as an operator?
Right.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, that's an important point. The identity operator is just some fill-in thing which helped us to fix the size of the space. So, you know, we did not have to do that. We could work with a fluctuating length sequence, but you see the advantage of this is that we can just insert and remove these operators. If we had not done the trick, then we would not be able to say that, okay, this is where we should insert, and we just insert. We would have to actually create a new element there, which of course we could do if we worked on some more, let's say, sophisticated data structure. We can have pointers and just insert something in a list wherever we like. The point is, this is much faster. You know, in sophisticated data structures can be nice and so on, but normally they take longer to actually do. So this is very, very fast to not have to actually create more elements there. And also, if we had that variable length space, those probabilities would, of course, be different. Okay, so that was the diagonal update. Okay, now let's look at some way in which we could do updates involving the off-diagonal operator. So here I show a couple of examples of local off-diagonal updates. So this is what corresponds to when we looked at just the path integral. We looked at those local deformations of word lines. So if we look at even the continuum, we could have a word line segment and then put in 2 events there. So that would be a local update of the word line. We can do something similar if we work with pairs of operators here. So if you take this part of the configuration, and now I just show it in this reduced representation where I just keep those what we need, the spin states and the operators. So now you see, if I just change the type of these 2 operators to diagonal, then this is what I get. So that will also then flip all these pins between us. You see that the states there are different. So that's an allowed thing to do. And if you think of these red ones as forming the word line, now what we did in this case is we actually removed two events. You see there was an event and an event there. And now we made that straight. So that's one thing we can do. Now, doing that, you have to keep in mind that there can be constraints. So, for example, if we try to do the same update here with these two guys that are enclosed in these dashed squares, you see, we could not do it because then those two red spins there would be flipped, and this would be an illegal operation because all operators can act only on parallel spins. So that would not be allowed. So we could do that only if there's nothing in between there. But there is one other way one could play with these two operators. So here I decided to change the spins between them in this way, but recall that we have periodic boundary conditions. So this is all should be imagined as something closed. And as Akosa pointed out last time, I mean, this is just illustrated for convenience. We could skip that and maybe that then it's more clear that it's actually periodic. There's nothing special with that state. It's doing one state here would be completely equivalent. It's just when we represent it on a two-dimensional space, we need to cut it somewhere. But we could also, instead of flipping the spins between here, which we could not do because of that constraint, but we could flip them in the other direction. So that would also lead to an allowed configuration, and that would explicitly affect the state that we have stored. So not normally this is the state that we have stored unless we are doing the diagonal update, in which case we propagate them. So that's something to keep in mind. So this could be done, and this was how this was done in the early days of these kind of methods, but it's not very efficient because these are local updates. So you can imagine if we have a low temperature, so low temperatures means that this space in the vertical direction is very long. We can only do these things typically when the operators are close to each other, because otherwise there will be likely something in between, like in this case. This is already far apart and there's one guy in between there. So these updates are very local, and they can of course not change the winding numbers. We talked about the winding number in the context of the path integrals, but you already have seen that these configurations, topologically speaking, are very similar, so there's also a winding number here, and these updates cannot change that. So let me quickly just mention what this loop update is, which allows us to actually change the winding number and so on. So it's just illustrated here. So you see here I have highlighted a loop, and this loop is formed in the following way. So if you construct a loop, you would start somewhere in some arbitrary place here. Let's say you start here. And then you can decide to move up. So you move up, and then when you hit, or you just do it in the link, so you immediately come to another operator or vertex. You move to the second leg of that vertex and you reverse the direction. So then you come there and then you just repeat those rules. And at some point that will form a closed loop. It will always form a closed loop at some point. But the point is that when you then flip all the spins that you have encountered, that corresponds to changing the type of the operator each time you hit an operator. Which also means that if you hit the same operator twice, as you do here, you actually don't change the time. So here you can see what you get when you actually do those spin flips and operator flips. So when you do this everywhere in this configuration, well, let's say you can do it in two different ways. You can start somewhere at random, make a loop, then start somewhere else at random, make a loop, and so on. The way it's normally done is that you construct all the loops. So you can imagine that this whole space will divide into a set of loops. All spins will belong to exactly one loop. And then you can flip half of them at random. That's normally what is done. And well, what is the reason that you can just flip this loop? Now it looks like, okay, you construct the loop and flip it. Well, this is where it was very convenient that all the matrix elements are equal to 1/2. Because that means that the weight of the configuration before and after the flip is actually exactly the same. So then according to the rules of the Metropolis algorithm, the flip probability can be 1, or actually any number. So in the Metropolis algorithm, normally we write the flip probability this way, or the update probability. So this would be the probability of accepting A goes to B. So now if the weights are the same, we can always do the flip. Now I just told you that we don't always do the flip. We namely construct all the loops and flip them with probability 1/2. It turns out that if you just look at the detailed balance condition, if the weight doesn't change, you can decide to flip it with any fixed probability. So probability 1 would be okay if we construct them one by one. But if we construct all of them and flip all with probability 1, clearly that's not good, because that just corresponds to toggling back and forth between two configurations that just differ by all spins being flipped. So one can also accept with any fixed probability, and that's what we should do if we construct all of them. And of course, 1/2 is a natural choice for that probability. Okay, so now there's some pseudo code for how to do that, and let me now really do it quite fast. I think for those of you who may want to do something like this, you can easily learn the details. But one point that I want to make is that we have in advance constructed this storage of linked vertices. So that's a list in the computer in which we are jumping around. So you can think of that list as containing addresses for the next place we should go to when we construct this kind of loop. We will only need to visit each location once, because what we're going to do is we're going to construct all the loops, flip them with probability 1/2. So if we have constructed one loop, we never want to go there again. And we can do that by actually erasing the information that we use once we have visited. So to indicate that we have visited some place, we can set this integer, which is stored in this linked vertex representation, which I call x here. If that's less than 0, we can take that as an indication that we have been there already and should not go there again. And we also need to sometimes with 50% probability flip the loop, and with 50% not flip the loop. So we can distinguish between having flipped and not flipped by storing -1 or -2 in those places. So then the procedure for constructing all the loops is that we go through all this whole list X, which contains those links, and that list has 4 L elements, right? Because each operator has 4 legs or 4 links. And when we go through that list, if we find an element which is less than 1, that means we have already been there, so we should not go there again, so then we just skip that. So if we do find an element which is 0 or larger, then we first decide, should we flip that loop that we will start to construct? We do that with 50% probability, otherwise we will not flip. So if we decide to flip the loop, flip the loop would be this one actually, according to my rule here. -2 means flip. So if we flip it, we go through the loop and we set all the elements to -2. Otherwise we set the elements to -1. And just going through the loop is actually very simple, because it's just jumping on those links. Well, moving in the vertical direction is just going with the links. But we also need to move, let's see here. We also move, need to know how to move in the lateral direction. And it turns out, if you just think a little bit, you can see that this is correct. We can use a flip bit operation to do that. If I go back to sort of where I define these vertices. So this is how I represent the legs, 0, 1, 2, 3. And so if I flip, if I'm here, and anywhere I'm going to be, my numbers corresponding to the legs are going to be 0, 1, 2, 3. If I take modulus of 4, that's how I store them. So if I flip a bit of the address where I'm currently at, then I will get to the next one in the lateral direction. Okay, it's something you should look at carefully if you want to do it. So that's what those flip bits things do here. So here is when I set, well, where I erase the loop information. Here is when I go in the lateral direction. Let's see. Oh, okay, so sorry. This is where I go in the lateral direction. This is where I actually change the type of the operator. So you can also use just a flip bit to... So when you visit an operator, you also need to change this other storage representation of the operator. And even an odd corresponds to diagonal and off-diagonal. So if we just flip the zeroth bit of what we have stored there, that also corresponds to changing the type, as we do here, from off-diagonal to diagonal. So that's quite convenient in this representation, that a lot of things you do, you just work with some bits. And this is where we actually move in the list, in the lateral direction. And this is where we use the link. So now we use the link to go to the next operator, and then we erase that. And if we can come back to the original location, then we exit. So when I start, I store my original, well, I have at some point stored my original location. Well, that's where I, that's the loop index as well. So if I come back there, I'm done with that loop. So each little piece of code here does one step of moving laterally and using the link. That's one step here. So two addresses are used in that process.
Where do we do we keep track of whether the base layer changes or not? Like alpha not? Is that
So that will be done in a while. So that's a good point. So if the loop is internal, like this one, or whatever you call it, if it doesn't involve that state, then that state doesn't change. But these loops can clearly involve that stored state as well. So for example, if I start the loop here, it will actually go across here, come back here, and in that case it will be a very short loop. But then those two spins should actually be flipped as well. And that we need to do. And actually, to really understand how that is done, I would have to tell you exactly how to construct this linked list, because some aspect of that is going to be used. But I actually don't want to do that. So you can imagine, I think, that it's not so difficult to construct this linked list representation. And here is actually the pseudocode for it, but I don't want to go through all of this detail. You can look at it or ask me after if you like. But the point is that in the process of making this linked vertex representation, we will also store, so we will construct it from bottom to top in this representation. We will also store the first let's say events or operators involving each spin, and later we can actually use the information we have also when we erase those loops. We have those numbers plus minus one. We can actually change those spin states, and I explain how to do it here. But let me not explain in detail. But just let me just repeat again what we are trying to do. So if the loop involves this spin state, which is the spin state that we have stored, we need to update it. And we can do that with the information we get when we construct this list in combination with those numbers minus one and minus two. So we should only change the state if it's a flipped loop, of course. Right. Okay, so is it sort of clear what this is doing? Yeah.
I just wish to know, you take P to be V divided by 4.
Right.
And V can take value 0 to 4 L minus 1. Can
right.
V not be the fraction?
Oh yeah, good point. So this is integer division, right? So if you take an integer and divide by an integer in the computer, you get just the integer part of that. Right? Yeah, I should have pointed that out. So this is the location in the just where the operators are stored. Oh, sorry. Here, this B, right? And B refers to the locations of those vertex legs. Did you have a question?
Yes. How is this ergodic?
Good point.
Once to remove operators, only change what kind are there.
Right. Okay, so I cannot prove it to you here, but it's ergodic in combination with what we do with these diagonal updates.
Oh, so you do both?
Right.
Okay. I thought you were saying that was an alternative too.
No, you need to both, because as you noted, I mean, that other update doesn't even change the locations of the operators, right?
Yeah.
The point is that in combination, these two updates are ergodic. So first, you do a sweep of those updates, then you construct this list representation. You do all these loops, and that's one Monte Carlo sweep. Yep, so let's see. Okay, so now I'm pretty much done with explaining this algorithm. There's one other issue we need to talk about. So we have cut off this distribution, expansion at some length L. So up until now we just assume that, okay, L is big enough, but how do we know that it's big enough? Okay, so it's pretty easy. So what we do when we start, we just choose some small, so here I say small n, I mean small L. And then what will happen is that the simulation itself will push n to whatever it should be. So if our L is too small, we will actually notice that. Namely, well, let me go here. So if L is too small, that means we will not find any empty locations here. The space will be completely filled up. So if we find that L or N, so N, the number of operators, equals L, or let's say it's close to L, but we can use equal even. we should say close. Let's say if N is less, or N is larger than 2/3 of L or something like that, then we increase L. So we want to keep L something like N times N divided by 3, something like that. So then it will be adjusted automatically. So you can see that here, this is just a test for a 16 times 16 system at some beta equals 16. And you can see here, when we start, so this is N as a function of the sweep. And this top curve actually shows L. So the black dots here are just N. And you see first N grows. And L grows even faster because we want to keep that kind of ratio. And at some point, N flattens out, and L flattens out. So then it's fine. And later on, we can explicitly check if we do look at the distribution of N, and we see that it never reaches L. So in this case, oops. Sorry. So in this case, you can see L is something like 6500, and here the maximum N is just 5000 or something like that. So this is no approximation that we cut it off here. Okay, so now I'm unfortunately losing my voice today, but let's see if I can show you some results. So the first thing you may wonder is this really working? Is it exact in some sense? Okay, so what you always should do, you should compare it with some exact result. And we can use exact diagonalization, right? So we have learned how to diagonalize small lattices, so that's definitely something we can do. But even if that works, you may still worry, could some errors come in when they go to really big systems? So in the case of a 1D chain, we also have the beta ansatz, so we actually can have exact results for any chain we like. Well, I should say we cannot necessarily get any result we like, but at least the energy we can get from the beta ansatz. Okay, so let's look at some 4x4 exact diagonalization results. So what you see here is the susceptibility as a function of temperature. And here you see some Monte Carlo results, these red dots. And what I show here is the difference. I take the Monte Carlo result and I subtract the exact result. And you see, okay, I have some error bars, but the error bars here are very small. They're something like 10 to the minus 6. So this actually took, I forget now, but probably several days to get that kind of accuracy.
Yep.
Shouldn't we be worried that the error bars, though small, don't actually intersect zero?
Well, you should remember what an error bar is, what the error bar means.
95% confidence.
So what I mean by one error bar is typically one standard deviation.
Oh, 68.
So then it's like, yeah. So I think this is pretty much in agreement with that. Yeah, so you're right, one should always say what the error bar means. Some people would say two standard deviations and some people would say one. Well, here you also see that I have two sets of data. One I call improved estimator and one I call standard estimator. I haven't told you what an improved estimator is, but let me just quickly say what it is. So you see, when we do these loop updates, when we do the loop updates, and as I explained, we can in principle subdivide the whole system into loops, right? And the weight doesn't depend on the orientation of those loops. So here I show two orientations of one loop. So if I have n loops, I have 2 to the n possible combinations of the orientations of those loops. And it turns out that one can actually analytically sum over all, so when you measure something, you can sum the measurements, sometimes at least, over all the possible orientations of these loops. And that, as you imagine, will give you better statistics. And sometimes it helps a lot, actually, but in this case, when this is just a 4x4 system, it doesn't help a lot. Well, sometimes it helps a lot. You can see here, the red error bars are actually much smaller than the black ones. So that's one added advantage of this loop updates, that you can do these improved estimators. Okay, let's look at longer chains. So here we have some results for 1024 and 4096 sites. So that's already quite big. So if there are some problems, you would expect that it should come in here. These lines show the exact beta ansatz results, which are results for the ground state. So this here is also illustrating the fact that I can get the ground state, because what this is here is as a function of inverse temperature beta. And it's on a log scale, so here beta is 2 to the m, and m goes up to 14, so this is, 8,000 maybe. Actually, I guess 16,000 something, so this is very low temperature. So you can see that at higher temperatures, these are still pretty low, but still not low enough, I deviate, but then at sufficiently low temperature, I actually agree with the beta ansatz. So it's good to know that things work, right? Okay, so now let me talk about some results of the Heisenberg chain again, unless you have some more questions about the algorithm. Okay, so we talked about the Heisenberg chain based on exact diagonalization, right? And I promised you then to look at some longer chains. So we looked at the ground state energy already. Let's look at some thermodynamics. So we looked at the susceptibility as a function of temperature of the chain, and I showed you several chain lengths. So let's say you're limited to this 16 side chain, and this is the exact beta ansatz result. You might just draw a curve through this data and say, well, most likely it goes there. And this is in fact what people did when they first started to use exact diagonalization in the 60s and 70s. And people thought that this is what it does, because it extrapolates quite nicely to that point. But then it turns out that there's this low energy field theory that describes the low temperature properties of this model. And from that there's a prediction by Ian Affleck and collaborators that, okay, this is the zero temperature result, but then there's a quite interesting correction at finite temperature, which has a log. And you can imagine that the log changes very slowly, right? So with Monte Carlo results, one can actually see that. So you go lower and lower in T, and it doesn't seem really to ever get there. So this is based on, I forget now, 1024. So still based on this value, if you didn't know this exact result, maybe you will think that it goes there, but it actually should go there. So to look at that in detail, you can do different chain lengths. So here I did, up starting from 16, which we already had, 32, 64, and so on, up to 4096. And now I plot it on a log scale instead of the linear scale there. So this is where we eventually should go, that's that number. And now you can see that for every chain length, there's some characteristic temperature where it just dives to zero exponentially. And that's due to the finite gaps in finite systems. So there's a gap between the lowest singlet ground state and the lowest triplet, and that gap scales as 1 over L. And that's why on a temperature which is proportional to 1 over L, you get this finite size behavior. So before that, you see that I'm quite well converged, so you don't even see all this data because all the points are on top of each other here. The dashed line is actually this logarithmic form with T naught, which is not given by the theory. The theory just gives this with some T naught, and based on fitting the data, one can extract it. So, and actually T naught, if you include some other interactions or something like that, you would expect, for example, you've done the J1, J2 chain, you're doing in your homework. In that case, before you reach that dimerization transition, the only thing that should change is actually T0, and actually C as well. So C is sort of a velocity here, which in the Heisenberg chain is known. But when you go to some other case, it will change as well. but this form should be very general. All right.
Just the previous slide.
Yeah.
This formula, is it just for a particular temperature below? Or
all right, yeah. So this is a, technically speaking, it's the asymptotic low temperature form. So there would be some higher order corrections here that nobody knows what they are. But numerically, I mean, you can very clearly see it here that this form, which goes pretty well through these points, at some point it starts to deviate a lot. And that's around, well, what is it, temperature 0.02 or 3 or something like that. So it's not clear a priori up to what temperature it should work. Okay, so we looked at spin correlations before, and we looked at, well, we tried to see if we could somehow explain the data by this 1 over r with a log form based on the exact diagonalization, and as you recall, it looked sort of plausible, but it was not completely easy to see because the chains were too short. So this is again a zero temperature result. So if we want to use SSE, we have to make sure that we go to low enough temperature. And the way to do that is, if you don't, I mean, initially you may not know at all. So what you can do is just take some correlation function, for example, at the longest distance. That's, as you can imagine, that what the one that would be most sensitive to finite temperature. and you look at that as a function of this inverse temperature. And again, it's really convenient to use a log scale, not to waste resources, let's say, because this should happen on some, well, it may happen at some very low temperature, so you don't want to do a lot of high temperatures where nothing happens, right? So here you see that at high temperatures, this correlation is essentially zero. So this chain is very long, 4096. So at high temperatures, spins that are far away, they will not know about each other. But at some point, it starts to increase. And then, okay, I should have a little bit better data here, but I think you can imagine that at this point, it's pretty well converged. The error bar is pretty large there. So let's see what we get now. If we take converged results, we say, let's say at this temperature, and then look at it as a function of distance. And here again, even for the distance now, I use a log scale because there are lots of points. So I don't even necessarily want to compute the compute the correlation at all distances because it takes time even to measure it. So here I measure the correlation on again a log scale, and this is what I get, these red and black circles here for two different system sizes. And now you can see, and this is very characteristic, when you get to distances something like a quarter of the length of the system, you can start to see the influences of the boundaries. So here you see that if you take the 4096 as being probably okay here, then the 1024 starts to deviate up there. So what the solid line here is actually a fit to this log form. And even for the largest system, when you come to system size divided by 4 or something like that, you see deviations. But okay, this seems quite quite plausible that it's actually that form No, it's actually interesting because the log is something that sometimes you even neglect and say, oh, it's just a log. The log is changing so slow, we don't care about it. In this case, if you didn't know that there was a log there, and well, let's say you did not know anything about this form, you would just generate data like that, and you would say, well, it looks like a power law, right? It looks like a pretty straight line. And if you measure the slope of the line, you get that the power is maybe, well, I forget what it would be, around 0.9 or something like that. So slope 1, which corresponds to just 1 over r, is the dashed line here. So the log actually has some substantial influence, and if you don't know that there's a log, it's very hard to see it, because it's you could almost equally well fit a power law, but you would get the wrong power. let me just mention that as an alternative to studying things as a function of r, as we already did in exact diagonalization, we can take the longest distance on the chain and look at that as a function of the chain length. Again, you get something very similar. So this is again a fit to that logarithmic form. And this is the 1 over r. All right. Now, okay, so that's what I wanted to say about the chain. Let's look at these ladder systems. So the ladders are coupled chains. So we can say, okay, for a finite system, we have Lx times Ly. So this would be this is the x direction, and this is the y direction. So that would be a four-leg ladder, and Lx and Ly could be, in principle, arbitrary. If we're interested in the thermodynamic limit, then for these ladders, we would be interested in... here I did it the other way around. Anyway, you want to make it infinitely long, but keep a finite width. So here I imagine that they go in the vertical direction instead. Yep.
Do you mean that systems with even and odd Lx have different?
Right, so it should be even or odd number of rungs.
Okay.
Right. Oh, sorry. Number of, is that wrong? The number of chains.
Yes.
So here what I mean is that this is four coupled chains, right?
So you want the small one to be even odd.
Right. So yeah, so the point is that they have different properties for even or odd. So the odd ones are similar to the Heisenberg chain, meaning this 1 over r correlations with the log, and also no gap when the chain length goes to infinity. Whereas for even number of chains, we should actually have a gap, and the spin correlation should decay exponentially. Okay, let me show some pictures here. That makes it clearer. So it's actually, at least qualitatively, quite easy to understand why they are different, at least in hindsight. So let's... so now I drew it in the same way as there. I should really change up here. It's misleading. So this is a two-leg ladder. Let's see now. And now let's say JY is 1, meaning I have coupling in that direction, but I have no coupling in that direction. These couplings are antiferromagnetic. So we know that in that situation, on each rung here, you have a singlet, right? We have talked about that many times. So in that case, the ground state is just a singlet product. There are no fluctuations, if we think of it in terms of singlets. So the red bond corresponds to the singlet. Now let's see what happens if we just turn on the coupling in the x direction just a little bit. We will discuss this valence bond basis in more detail tomorrow and on Friday. But what will happen is that you can think of it as fluctuations in these singlets. So when Jx is very small, you will still essentially have just short singlets, but you have some fluctuations where a pair of them can flip over. Okay, and as we will also discuss in more detail, when you have these singlets and they are short, that means that the spin correlations are also short range, and you have a gap in the spectrum. So here, of course, it's clear what the gap is, because the excitation just corresponds to making one triplet, right? And that costs energy J, which is just one here. And even if you have such fluctuations, if these bonds are still short, the gap will be there. Okay, now let's see what you get if you have an odd number, like in this case 3. And again, this corresponds to this picture here, the case where I only have coupling in the y direction, not in the x direction. It turns out that the ground state of 3 spins like that can be written as a singlet plus a non-paired spin. And of course it's doubly degenerate, so you could put the singlet there and the unspin paired spin there as well. Actually it's fourfold degenerate, because the unpaired spin of course can be up or down. Was there a question? Okay, so if you just look at no coupling between the chains, you have a highly degenerate ground state, and this would just be one example of such a ground state. Okay? What happens now when you couple also these rungs and the coupling is weak? Well, it turns out that you would like to have the possibility of fluctuating these singlets, and they can only fluctuate like that if they line up. In this kind of situation, you cannot have fluctuations that involve only short singlets. And you may say, well, why should I only have short singlets? I guess maybe it will become more clear on Thursday or Friday, but that's the way it is, let's say. So to enable these singlets to fluctuate, you want to line them up, and then you're left with all these unpaired ones up here. And in fact, we could explain those with singlets as well in this basis, but then those would be long singlets. So this will basically be like a leftover chain, and that's why the 3 chains will behave like qualitatively like the single chain. Yep.
Why is it that you don't see any fluctuations, though, of unpaired spins replacing singlets that are vertical there?
Oh, so you mean fluctuating like that?
Yeah, because you have these long...
Well, actually, you would have such fluctuations as well. So this is just a cartoon picture of, let's say, the state without fluctuations. So you would have also such fluctuations, but you still would have a majority of the singlets on one side.
And then there'd be a degeneracy as to which side.
Right. Okay. Exactly. Good point. There's no reason why they should be there. They could be here. So. Okay, so that's qualitatively why these are falling in 2 different categories. So let's see. Okay, since now we are out of time and I'm also out of voice today, so I think it's better we continue tomorrow. So tomorrow I will just give you a few more properties of these chains, and then we will start talking about this valence bond basis. All right, see you tomorrow.